Morning. Be seated.
Morning, Your Honor.
The United States District Court is now in session. The Honorable Timothy S. Hellman presiding. Today is July 24th, 2008. In the case of Three Angels versus Joy and Pickle, civil action number 0740098FDS. Counsel, please identify yourself for the record.
Your Honor, on behalf of the plaintiffs, Three Angels Broadcasting Network and Daniel E. Shelton, I'm M. Gregory Simpson.
Mr. Simpson?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Your Honor. John Pucci from Northampton for the plaintiffs.
Morning.
Good morning.
Kaylin Arthur Joy, the pro se for defense.
Good morning to you, Mr. Joy. Mr. Pickle, I understand that you're here.
Yes, I am.
I hate to tell you how many times I actually look at the ceiling when I ask that question, so if you were here, you would appreciate the comedy in that. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay.
Good. Give me one second, please. All right, as I understand it, this is a hearing on a motion filed by the defendant Robert Pickle to compel production from Three Angels and Danny Lee Shelton, and that's documents number 61. And document number 74 is a motion of the plaintiffs for a protective order limiting the scope and methods of discovery. Is that your understanding, Mr. Pickle?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Joy?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Simpson?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And are you going to be speaking on behalf of the...
Yes, I will.
I don't care. It's up to you guys. All right, Mr. Pickle... I'm going to start with your motion. Thank you. Also, I need you to give some thought, and I want to hear from you about whether or not I should enter some sort of an order regulating your discovery, since nobody seems to be able to get along here. So, start with your motion, and then I will hear from Mr. Simpson in opposition.
Okay, Your Honor. The plaintiff's complaint is quite broad, and it does not limit itself to just specific issues due to the language that it uses or specific time periods. Maybe more specifically, I should refer to the defendant's answer in paragraph 9. The defendants say that they have upon information and belief, sufficient information to believe that 3ABN may actually be controlled by plaintiff Danny Lee Shelton, and that plaintiff treats the corporation as his own asset and purposely profits from the same.
And also, what paragraph in the answer, please?
That would be our answer to paragraph 9.
So is it your paragraph 9?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Is it your paragraph 9?
The way that we did it, we quoted the complaint and then gave an answer to that paragraph. So I guess you could say it's answer of defendant to 9.
Okay. Thank you.
And then also answer of defendant to 14.
Yeah.
Where, and the language here is more or less used in a number of paragraphs throughout the answer. Answer of defendant to 14, toward the end of it, it says, upon information and belief, the actions of the plaintiff Danny Lee Shelton, purportedly a founder and either current or former president of 3ABN, has conducted himself in such a way as to violate theological integrity, undermine operational capabilities, to prey upon the financial soundness of the entity 3ABN, and to inappropriately redirect large sums to his personal benefit with and without properly constituted corporate authority. And I just want to point out that we do not limit that to specific topics or time periods. The U.S. Supreme Court has held in Oppenheimer Fund, Inc. versus Standard that discovery is not limited to issues raised by the pleadings, for discovery itself is designed to help define and clarify the issues, nor is it limited to the merits of a case, for a variety of fact-oriented issues may arise during litigation that are not related to the merits. Now, we have reserved requests produced by the plaintiffs on August 20th, and I entered my appearance, so to say, mid-November, and one of the first things that I did after doing that was to prepare the requests produced. In preparing my requests produced, I modeled them to some extent after the ones that the plaintiffs had served on us. So they used the word all this, all that, and so I used the word all. The idea of putting plaintiff-related issues in the definitions, I got that from the plaintiffs, because they had defined statements of fact in their definitions and then referenced that throughout their request produced. And that's what gave me the idea to do the plaintiff-related issues, to try and make it more efficient, to produce this document in a more efficient way. In my opening paragraph of my instructions for my request produced, I asked for a time period through the present, thereafter on a continuing basis, until the disposition of the trial of this matter. That wording was borrowed directly from the plaintiff's request produced that they served upon us. They asked for a document through the present, thereafter on a continuing basis, until the disposition of the trial of this matter. In mid-November, they filed two motions in U.S. Bankruptcy Court, November 13, 2007, their motion for relief from the automatic stay, and their motion for expedited determination of their motion for relief from the automatic stay. And in both those motions, they referred to continuing defamatory conduct or ongoing defamatory conduct. So they didn't limit it just to events between 2001 and January 2007. The plaintiffs would like to handcuff us so that we can't prepare our defense. What they originally said regarding the request produced, that everything that we asked for was privileged, confidential, or irrelevant. However, the magistrates in Minnesota and Michigan that have heard some of these issues have ordered production of the documents that we requested by our third-party subpoenas. We were all set to, but we retained the services of two auditors and a certified fraud examiner. And two of those individuals were to meet us in Marion, Illinois on June 24th to go over the auditor's records that we had subpoenaed. We've been told by our experts that they need these auditors, particularly the auditor's work papers. And they were going to go over these records and determine what could be used for our defense, and then these documents were to be copied on our own equipment in order to save expense to the auditor. So we try to be responsible and reasonable in our request, and our experts have said they need this material. How we came up with what we requested and the request produced, we interviewed many current former employees of 3ABN, many of them management, and we took the various allegations of wrongdoing and impropriety, and we tried to craft relevant requests to produce material that would lead to admissible evidence. Once the court ordered in March the plaintiffs to produce their Rule 26A1 material, and once we went through those materials, and we discovered that a lot of these printouts of web pages, internet web pages, they contained the same allegations that we had put into our request to produce. At least we put into our request to produce, looking for documents dealing with these various allegations. Well, those same allegations are found in the plaintiff's Rule 26A1 material, these printouts of web pages from internet forums. So if the plaintiff's Rule 26A1 materials are relevant, then our requests produced are relevant. If our requests produced are not relevant, then the vast majority of the materials that the plaintiff gave us in the Rule 26A1 material are not relevant either.
That's fair enough. Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Have you received the initial disclosures under Rule 26 from what purports to be initial disclosures from the plaintiffs?
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I was just referring to.
Okay. And have you served your own initial disclosures upon the plaintiffs?
We did that in August.
Okay.
Last year.
All right, thank you. And have you served any interrogatories on the plaintiffs?
We have not served any interrogatories at this point.
Have the plaintiffs served any interrogatories upon yourself?
Yes.
Okay. And what's the status of those, please?
I served my responses, I think, in September.
Okay. And then have the plaintiffs served any Rule 34 requests upon you?
And Rule 34 would be?
That's a request for production of documents.
Yes, so they served those on August 20th, and mine were modeled after those, theirs in the way that I described. And I responded to those requests produced in September. And one of the things I put in there was my phone record.
Okay.
Among other things.
Thank
we turned
you.
Over thousands and thousands of documents to them in our initial disclosure. Well, I guess I'm getting a little mixed up. We had already turned over everything in our initial disclosures, and so there wasn't much to turn over in response to the request to produce.
As a supplement to your initial disclosures?
Yes.
Gotcha. All right, thank you. I'm going to hear from Mr. Simpson when I may come back to you. Mr. Simpson, please.
Thank you, Judge. And I think Mr. Pickle's comments address really both motions, so I'm not sure how to...
Well, I'm going to come back to you on your motion, and then I'll let him respond. But
thank you, Judge. On Mr. Pickle's motion, my three of you and Mr. Shelton's position is that the motion is moot and should be denied without prejudice to refile in the event that further issue comes up in the future. At the time that he brought the motion, we were in the process of negotiating for what types of documents would be produced, and we were gathering the records that would be responsive. The Rule 26A1 disclosure had happened in March. I mean, actual documents, I might be wrong on the month, but they had already occurred. He'd received some 10,000 pages of documents at that time, and then we moved into producing additional documents that were specifically responsive to the request for production served by Mr. Pickle. And we were having a dialogue which is exhaustively detailed in one of the affidavits about, I think it was the one from Jerry Hayes, that was kind of nearing an impasse when the motion was filed. At that point, we proposed in a letter from Ms. Hayes that's in her affidavit that we would produce documents that we thought, because the problem was we couldn't tell exactly what he was asking for. And we were gathering records that we thought that we knew he was asking for, but we weren't sure where the parameters of that would lie. So we produced the documents pursuant to a schedule that we thought we had agreed to as part of a meet and confer that occurred in June 5 and June 6 with Mr. Joy and Mr. Pickle. Later turned out that Mr. Joy and Mr. Pickle didn't feel that they had agreed to that schedule. But the understanding that we had at that meeting confer was that if we produced the documents pursuant to our schedule, that they would withdraw their motion to compel without prejudice and refile it at a later time if we reached an impasse. But the reason why we believe that the motion is moved now is because there's been an additional 6,000 pages or so of documents produced, and now they have what we think they've asked for. And so now we need to go through the process contemplated in Local Rule 37.1. It's the same rule pretty much everywhere, that you have to have a dialogue about what's missing, and they have to explain how they've asked for something, and then we explain we gave it to you, or we didn't know you wanted it, and now that we know it, we're going to give it to you, or now that we know you want it, we're just not going to give it to you because of, and then give a reason. That process is what hasn't happened. And that's why we believe the motion should be denied at this stage without prejudice. And then we should come back after we have exchanged a few letters, refined the issues, and we can come back to you with a finite list of issues that we disagree on. I proposed that to them in a letter dated July 9, 2008. It's in Kristen Kingsbury's affidavit, which is document number 92, exhibit 29 to that, and they haven't actually, they verbally responded that they would get back to me on that, and they didn't do that, or not yet anymore. So that's my position, and I could address some of the issues that Mr. Pickle talked about. He talks about, and this is kind of getting into the next motion, but he mentioned that the complaint is quite broad. It's not. It's anything but quite broad. There are 24 specific, factual, defamatory, what we say are defamatory statements that are selected out from the hundreds, if not thousands, of disparaging remarks that they've made. But we only selected 24 for suit, and those are found in the complaint, part of my next presentation, at pages 12 through 14. And they're not broad, they're narrow. And they are specific events that occurred at specific points in time. Now, what's broadened the case up is, as Mr. Pickle himself demonstrated, their answer goes all over the place. It adds new disparaging remarks that we didn't sue them for. And what he's really saying is bootstrapping his discovery request onto his answer, because his answer states new disparaging remarks that we never sued them for in the first place. So they're trying to expand the scope of discovery by their own allegations, which are not in the nature of defense. The truth is, as I understand it, is what they're really saying is that they're defense. And they cannot expand the scope of the issues in the case and get more discovery through their own efforts of making new defamatory remarks. He says that he borrowed from our discovery request, and it could be true that he borrowed the format, but I'm quite sure that we didn't ask questions that were as overly broad as his, and I'm going to get to that.
Did he borrow your instructions and definitions?
Not the definitions, but some of them are standard definitions, but not the ones that we're complaining of. And he probably took the word all from ours, but ours would have been more narrowy, and I don't have the impression. I'm playing a bit of catch-up, and I don't have our request for production in mind. I'm not sure I've even read them, because they weren't an issue.
I often think that a lot of these discovery disputes begin with the instructions portion of the Rule 34 request, and this may be another one of those situations. And that cuts both ways, by the way. So. Anyway, go ahead.
Comment. He's also saying that our disclosure of materials under Rule 26A1 is some sort of admission of relevance. And I think the rule is pretty clear on that to encourage people to be more generous with what they give up under Rule 26A1 as voluntary disclosure, you do not waive any objections to scope, relevance, that sort of thing. I think that's in the rule, and it might be in the commentary to the rule. So that's what I wanted to say on Mr. Pickle's motion. I do have more to say about the other motion.
Let me just stop you for a moment. When did you serve the latest round of documents on the defendants?
Mr. Pickle and Mr. Joy will correct me if I misstated, but we produced all of the documents that we intended to produce by the first or second week of July, and then we produced a privilege log after that. It's actually in the record, so I'll stand corrected if there's a letter that sets forth what we were going to do.
Mr. Pickle, when did you get that latest round of documents and the privilege log?
We got the privilege log on July 10th. and we received that by fax. The last actual documents that were served upon us, or served upon me, were served by mail on June 27th, and then I would have received them after that.
June 27th?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And what was the volume of that package?
The total of the three. Say the first one was 199. Let me see if I can find quickly the second.
No, you know, just give me a rough idea. I'm just trying to get a sense.
Well, the total that was served between June 13 and June 27, totaled 3,585 pages.
And right. have you had a chance to go through those documents and assess their responsiveness to your requests?
I have. And it has been a time-consuming process, Your Honor, because these were delivered totally unindexed without any way for me to know what was responsive to what. And so I have gone through those. I would like to point out request number 9. Dealt with a number of different accounting-type documents. And we have, just for example, we have over 280 invoices, or pages of invoices, for Smith and Butterfield. And I was kind of at a loss to know how those were responsive at all. But, you know, request number 9, I'm turning there now. One thing it asks for is documents containing detail. It would break down the categories on the financial statements and the Form 990 that pertain to auto, expense, bad debt, cost of goods sold, love gifts, and such. You know, this kind of goes to the question of private enormity. Okay, love gifts. We know we have I think you'd call him a high-level former employee of 3ABN who claims to have seen a $10,000 check in 1999 that went to Tommy Shelton, who wasn't even an employee at 3ABN at the time.
Wait a minute, stop for a minute. I'm looking at your request for production of documents.
Yes.
And you're directing me to request number 9?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And where in there are you, what are you referring to, please?
Okay, down toward the bottom of the request,
yeah.
There's a bunch of categories there. Auto, bad debt,
yeah.
Cost of goods sold, and love gifts. I'd like to point out just those two categories.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got these lump categories, these lump figures on the financial statements in 990. I wanted the breakdowns of those. I wanted the breakdown of what, I wanted something giving me, documents giving me the detail of what that total figure for love gifts was. Because I wanted to know about, I wanted to verify whether or not that $10,000 check was sent to Tommy Shelton as a love gift in 99. That would be just one example for love gifts. But I didn't get anything giving detail for love gifts.
Let me ask you this, and I'm getting a little bit off a task, but why wouldn't you just specifically ask the question, what was the check for, and where was it, and where was it entered into the bookkeeping system?
I believe, well, our understanding is that's just one example of, and that this is not the only type of love gift problem that there is.
Well, what is it that leads you to believe that it was filed under love gifts?
A former high-level employee has told us that that is where some of these things are hidden.
I see. Okay.
Now, I'd like to point out one thing about the cost of goods sold. I did get one document that comes close to breaking down the detail for the cost of goods sold figure that is on both the Form 990 and the financial statements. And this document deals with just the year 2006, and it lists satellite system sales, $1.162 million worth of sales, which corresponds with the figure that's on the 990s and the financial statement. It's about a $2,000 difference between the two figures, but it looks like that's the figure. Okay, the cost of goods sold here on this, in this document that I received, says $640,809, giving a 44.9% profit. And the problem is that the figure for cost of goods sold on the 990s and the financial statements for 2006 for satellite system sales is over $1 million. And so we've got a $350,000 discrepancy with no explanation.
Well, that's, and I'm not going to tell you how to prepare your case, but there's another form of discovery that you can utilize called either an interrogatory or a deposition where you get to specifically ask those questions. But we're going to talk about that in a bit. All right, thank you. Your answers were helpful. All right, let's move to document 74, and that is the plaintiff's motion for protective order. And let me hear you on that, please, Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Judge. And if I may just comment on a few of the last things that he said, if I understood his comments about request number 9, he's complaining that we produced too much information, not that he didn't feel it was responsive, and that just kind of illustrates how difficult it was for us to interpret. We produced those Smith and Butterfield invoices because we thought they were responsive to requests 9 and 10. I still think they're responsive to 9 and 10, but if he didn't want them, it's really not, it's not an issue that's worthy of bringing a motion to compel. And then the broader issue is asking about cost of goods sold. What they're trying to do is find new incidents of wrongdoing. And this segues into my motion, the three of you and Danny Shelton's motion to limit the scope and methods of discovery. They're trying to do a complete re-audit of all of 3ABN's activities, not just financial, but other activities as well, as part of their broader mission, which they view as kind of reporting on wrongdoing in the 3ABN organization. And we've sued them for these 24 specific statements, but what they're trying to do is find new acts of wrongdoing that they did not previously know about and find evidence in support of that. And we're trying to limit them to the issues in the case which are defined by the complaint. So that's what this motion is for, is to narrow the scope of discovery to the relevant topics and to control the third-party discovery that's been going on. There are really two prongs of this motion. The first is the request for production that have been served on the plaintiffs, and the second prong is the third-party discovery that has been served on the six people who have received subpoenas, six that we know about. There might be others that we don't know about. And on the first prong, that is the discovery, the request for production served on the plaintiffs, our basic complaint is that they're grossly overly broad. The requests go well beyond what's necessary to defend themselves against the allegations in the complaint, which require them to prove that their statements, that their allegedly defamatory statements were true. There's an item-by-item list of what our particular grievances are as to each document request that's found in the Kingsbury Affidavit Document 92 at Exhibit 19. And to cut to the chase, what we would like to happen is, and it's going to be a challenge to craft an order that does this without unfairly limiting, that anticipates all the problems that could come up, but we would like an order limiting the topics of discovery, the permissible topics, and the permissible date range, and basically to have them redraft their request for production formally or informally to articulate what it is they want. And I guess the court's comment earlier about just serving as an interrogatory, asking about a specific transaction, is really all that's necessary. To make this more concrete, and we're talking at a hopeless level of abstraction, so I wanted to make it more real by going to the source documents, which are the complaint and the request for production of documents. And the complaint at page 12 is where under the heading Defendant's Untrue Statements begins, paragraph 46A. And I'm not going to go through all of them because it would take more time than the court probably wants to take on this, but in 46A is the first allegation of an untrue statement, and we say there that for the last several years, so we're limiting it in scope, the international television ministry known as Three Angels Broadcasting Network has found itself beset by a growing number of moral, ethical, and financial allegations. Despite the serious nature of these allegations, repeated calls for investigation, reform, and accountability have gone unheeded by its officers and directors. So That's the allegation, allegedly defamatory statement. Now, what information would be necessary that's within the possession of 3ABN to prove that that is a true statement? And the answer, I think, would be all of the minutes that the board, because this is about failure of oversight by the board, so all of the information that was in front of the board is what would be responsive to that for the period, specific period of time, beginning in the early 2000-2001 time frame, and extending until the time of the lawsuit. Now let's compare that to what Mr. Pickle has asked for, which is in this request for production of documents. Let's just go to the first one, request number one. All minutes and other documents of the 3ABN board, so far so good, but it goes on, for the entire length of time of 3ABN's existence and on an ongoing basis. So, I mean, that would go back 20, 25 years, and the allegation and the complaint only deals with events dating back to 2001. So what we're saying, this is the simplest example, it gets hairier as you go through these, but the simplest example is we've made an allegation about something they said that relates to a specific point in time. Documents, we agree, would be discoverable, and we've given them all of the minutes back to 2001. All of the, everything, every scrap of paper that the board had in front of it at the board meetings has been produced, is my understanding, and back to 2001. And we are asking to have their request narrowed to reflect that, what I think is an obvious limitation. Another example, let's just take the next one in line. Danny Shelton purchased, this is on page 12 of the complaint, Danny Shelton purchased a 3-year-old van using 3ABN funds, then sold the van to a member of his family for just $10. So what documents would be necessary to prove the truth of that statement? Well, there would be maybe the certificate of title for that van, there would be a check stub, maybe there would be a document memorializing it. So they can ask for that, and we'll give it to them. If they can identify it, what they want, we'll give it to them. And just go through it. These are all specific events that don't require, but what have they asked for? They've asked for every banking record from Danny Shelton going back for, I don't know how many years, 6 years, I think, was in the subpoena. They want his entire, this is the subpoena they served in Minnesota on Danny Shelton's personal bank. They want all of his banking records going back pretty much forever. And that's just not necessary to prove this, you know, single transaction was or was not a bad transaction. And there's other transactions in here, but they're all specific transactions. Now, they say that they've got an allegation of personal inurement, but that sentence goes on that there's specific allegations of personal inurement. It's not a general allegation of personal inurement, so they get to conduct full discovery on everything that's ever happened. They made specific comments that we say are defamatory that relate to specific transactions that they allege as personal inurement. And those are the allegations in the complaint, and they're trying to use the discovery mechanism to find new instances of personal inurement. And that's an improper expansion of the issues in the case. I can go through and do that same analysis with each of these. There's just no match between the allegations in the complaint, which are narrow, and the broad, really unlimited request for documents. Now, you might wonder why they're doing this. Well, I touched on it earlier, that the defendants consider themselves a class of ecclesiastical journalists, and that it's part of their mission to expose, to investigate 3ABN. That's what they do, and they post all their findings on the internet, and that's what started this whole thing in the first place. And they have actually exchanged correspondence, which is in Ms. Kingsbury's affidavit, discussing the fact that the complaint is fairly narrow and they need to come up with creative ways of expanding the scope so they can get more information for their broader goal. So this actually is their intent. It's not just that they don't know how to craft narrowly tailored requests. They actually want everything so that they can find more instances of wrongdoing. So what should the order say and that's really the challenging part. We believe that the brief kind of asks for what we think would be an appropriate order with respect to each request. But again, this is kind of the flip side of the first motion. What needs to happen is there needs to be a full compliance with Rule 37.1, the local rule that requires that the party who wants additional discovery identify the specific item that they want and the document request where it comes from, and then their position on it, and then we respond to it, and then we present our various positions on that finite set of specific issues to you to resolve. And maybe we can resolve it ourselves. The track record doesn't suggest we will do it, but possibly we could. But in any case, we'll end up with a finite list of documents that we believe should not be produced and they believe should be produced that actually exist, and then there will be something concrete for the court to order. But right now, it would be kind of hopelessly abstract. And then the second prong of this motion deals with the third-party discovery, and I want to just touch briefly on that. There's been, I think, 6 subpoenas served by the defendants on third parties in various jurisdictions. And the status, the one in Minnesota, was for Danny Shelton's personal bank records. And Judge Boylan there ordered disclosure of those records to you under seal, thinking that you would be the appropriate person to determine what's relevant and what's not, and he wasn't. He wasn't in a position to do that. So whether you want to do that task or not, those records will be arriving someday, and we need to address what to do with them. And my proposal would be either that you address that in this order as to what, and we can take it back to Judge Boylan, and then he can narrow his order, I recognize you can't order him to do anything, but the comedy and so forth between the courts, my understanding is that he would invite a suggestion from this court as to what's relevant.
We have, when this first landed, we communicated.
Okay. And if the documents arrive here before that can happen, then I would suggest that we either the court or the court appoint somebody to do an in camera review of those documents in light of the allegations in the complaint and determine which documents are responsive to the document requests and relate to issues in the complaint. I don't envy that task, but that's somebody's got to do it. That's the Minnesota subpoena. The Illinois subpoena is on Gray Hunter, which is an accounting firm that does 3ABN's accounting work. The plaintiffs moved to quash that subpoena, and Gray Hunter joined in that motion because there's an Illinois accounting privilege that doesn't pertain to filed accounting records, so the tax returns and so forth would not be subject to the privilege. But the work papers, which is what they want, because they already have the tax returns themselves, they want the work papers, would be considered privileged under Illinois law as a matter of substantive Illinois law. And so that issue was kind of stayed because we told the court there that, in fact, we had a hearing scheduled for today in Illinois, and we asked the court there to move it indefinitely to get some guidance from this court as to what the scope of relevancy would be. So that's the status of the Illinois subpoena of the accounting records. We moved to quash them, that subpoena. We don't believe, it's like 10 banker's boxes. It's every accounting record going back forever. And it relates to way more than what the issues are in the case. And we think it's just way overbroad. Again, they need to identify what specific issues, and they don't need to go to our accountants for that. We can give them the documents that relate to the issues in the case. The third subpoena that I know of is the Michigan subpoena on Remnant Publications. That's a publishing house that publishes books that are purchased by 3ABN, or in this case authored by Danny Shelton, and then purchased by 3ABN and given away as part of their outreach program or sold as part of their outreach program. I think that the deal is that people who want the book pay for some nominal fee for the shipping and handling or whatever. And that the judge there ordered disclosure of those records, which is basically all of the dealings and contracts between Remnant and the plaintiffs. And initially the judge had said that she would be ordering disclosure to you following suit with Judge Boylan, and then when the order came out, she changed her mind and said that the documents could go directly to Mr. Pickle and Mr. Joy without any intervening review for screening. And Remnant's attorney has moved for reconsideration, and that motion is pending at the last time I heard. So we would ask that, and I'm not sure, you can't tell a judge in Michigan what to do, but I think that if your order were to address the issue of that subpoena and whether you felt it was relevant, that's something we could take to that judge that would then prompt her to reconsider or not reconsider, according to whatever you tell her. Then there are two other subpoenas that did not result in litigation. One was served on Kathy Bottomley, who was a former employee of 3ABN, who made allegations of sexual harassment or discrimination of some sort in California. It was investigated by the California agency that does that, and there was no finding of probable cause, and it ended. And these folks have, the defendants have made allegations that 3ABN violated the anti-discrimination laws, citing as an example Kathy Bottomley and another employee. And so these documents were, I think we provided them to them first, and then they also, I might have it switched, but in any case, they've obtained the documents now from two sources, Kathy Bottomley and from 3ABN. And then the final subpoena is on a pastor by the name of Glenn Dryden, for his records relating to Tommy Sheldon, who was a pastor at a church. Glenn Dryden replaced him when he left that church. And Tommy Sheldon is not a party to this lawsuit. And there's allegations that he was engaged in sexual misconduct with underage boys, and terrible allegations. There's been no criminal prosecutions, no lawsuits that I'm aware of. But he was employed by 3ABN when those allegations came to light. They terminated the employment, and he's no longer connected to 3ABN. So the allegations in allegedly defamatory remarks were that 3ABN didn't fire him soon enough. I'm summarizing that correctly. That knew but didn't fire him, should have known about his conduct but didn't fire him soon enough. And what these folks are doing is taking that incident, or that I would agree that what 3ABN knew and when they knew it is relevant, but it's not relevant to go to third parties and just kind of snoop about what Tommy Sheldon was up to. And that's what they're doing. That's what these subpoenas are all about. And when I asked them for these records, they wouldn't even produce me the records that they obtained through use of these subpoenas. Mr. Joy took the position that it wasn't relevant, that they weren't relevant, and that therefore I couldn't ask for them. And I said, well, what are you using Rule 45 to obtain records for if they're not relevant? And they eventually gave them to me. And I haven't looked at them, so I can't tell you if they're relevant or not, but I would suspect they're not. So those are the subpoenas that are out there, and I think the point I want to make about those third-party discovery is that it doesn't make any sense for courts in other jurisdictions to be deciding relevance and scope and whether these are appropriately appropriate documents to be seeking from third parties. It would make more sense for this court, who's more familiar with the issues in the case, to make a preliminary ruling on that. And I'm proposing that henceforth, Mr. Pickle and Mr. Joy be required to obtain leave of this court before serving any third-party discovery. And those are the issues that I wanted to address in my motion.
Thank you. Let me hear from you, Mr. Pickle, and then I'll hear from Mr. Joy.
Sorry for the pause, Your Honor. Would it be all right if you hear from Mr. Joy first and then come back to me?
Sure. Mr. Joy?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start off by making it very clear to this court I never challenged the relevance of anything. Okay. In fact, I have consistently, from the beginning of this case, taken the position, discover everything. They want something, give it to them. I don't care whether it's relevant or not. We had a battle over that issue with counsel that was representing Mr. Pickle at the time. My position was, take everything, give it to them. And my position remains the same. And I have never challenged the relevance of any document that this man has ever questioned. And that's only one of several frauds on this court. This man represented that the subpoena, it was issued in the state of Minnesota, dealt with the question of relevance, but the order underlying that dealt with relevance. It didn't deal with relevance, it dealt with confidentiality. And it was agreed that the documents be put under seal pending a confidentiality order, not a relevance and scope order. That is clearly not in the order and was not part of the discussion at that time. The subpoena to Ray Hunter Sten, we have a case where these people have alleged defamation per se. They're saying, hey, look, these people have made allegations that are violations of the Internal Revenue Code and therefore criminal. That's their allegation, all right? Obviously, experts regarding the issue of whether or not those are in fact in violation would need those documents. They would need the bank statements from Minnesota, and they would need the documents from Remen Publication, and they would need a lot of other documents that we do not have at this point. They absolutely are covered by scope, and they're absolutely covered by the complaint. There's no question they're covered by the complaint. The allegations in the complaint specifically talk about abuses by the board of directors and by Danny Lee Shelton, both the assets of 3ABN, etc. Clearly it goes to the question of scope and relevance. And there's just no way that all of a sudden arbitrarily setting a date of 2001 works, because many of our allegations go back long before 2001. We arbitrarily set our date as 99, when in reality, for example, the board meeting minutes would obviously be relevant all the way back to the founding of the corporation. If we've made an allegation that's relevant to the way that the board of directors had mismanaged the corporation, effectively not managed the corporation for nearly 25 years, all of those board records would clearly be relevant. And the scope could not be limited to 2001, a ludicrous at best, given their own allegations against us. And the other thing I'd like to point out, Your Honor, is that we had already come to an agreement with Litzenberg, counsel for Ray Hunter Sten. They were not going to oppose this. We had worked out a stipulated agreement that we would bring in two auditors and a forensic accountant to review all of these documents with us over 3 days to determine what was relevant, what was not relevant. In addition, we were bringing the equipment to be able to address the question of confidentiality. They would be copied and watermarked. And then those documents would then be scanned into a separate system for our own preservation purposes for trial, as well as having, obviously, the copy made at the point of discovery. That all of a sudden came to naught when suddenly people who were not parties to this, Three Angels Broadcasting Network under Rule 45, they're not parties to this particular request, and they claim all of a sudden that Illinois confidentiality comes into play, when it's known by everybody in the world that federal common law does not recognize any type of client accountant privilege. And Litzenberg had agreed to that. And that's why we had an agreement in place as to how we were going to conduct that discovery, to preserve confidentiality, to preserve relevance, and to preserve scope. As for Remen Publications, Your Honor, I would point out that in their own complaint, they have specifically alleged that we had said that they had hidden Mr. Shelton's royalties relevant to the production of books, and that they had then failed to disclose those at any point in the 3ABN 990s or
other documents filed with the state of Illinois. Well, in fact, we had good information, and we produced that information to this court to demonstrate the relevance and scope of that particular subpoena. And the fact is that they've made the allegation. They have specifically made an allegation. And in fact, we believe the allegation to be true based on the representation of at least two employees at Remnant Publications and other employees that came from Three Angels Broadcasting Network. That information was given to us. He didn't even ask for it. It came out of the blue sky one day. We got an email, and we obviously moved on that because even though we had suspected it, and even though Mr. Miller, who had originally been on the board of directors at 3EBN, had alleged it to us, okay, we had no firm evidence of that until we got inside information that, in fact, that was correct. So these were all relevant. They were all part of the scope. They were all within the allegations that the plaintiff has made. There's no question about that. And the problem that we really have here is we have a very reluctant plaintiff. We have a plaintiff who clearly has determined that they're going to do everything they can from day one to obstruct our ability to get information that we need to defend against the allegations of defamation per se, which they have purported to be allegations of defamation per se. And the point is, Your Honor, very simply, we have done everything that we can to be compliant. We have always produced documents. The only thing that I'm aware of that's currently outstanding on our side is that I do have to amend my answers to interrogatories relative to specific issues, reference to sources, etc. That's the only outstanding issue that I'm aware of that we have not yet responded to. Otherwise, we've been entirely forthcoming. The problem we have is we have a plaintiff who clearly doesn't intend to be forthcoming and frequently misrepresents or mischaracterizes the underlying issues. And let me say too, Your Honor, that it is in fact true that the judge magistrate in Michigan initially said, well, I'm going to produce these, but I'm going to produce them under seal to Judge Hillman in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And then she very pointedly notes that upon reconsideration, obviously having looked at the record and the transcript and the allegations, etc., she notes that they were relevant. She doesn't have any question as relevance here. And then they go back and say, well, we want you to reconsider because we're filing this new motion to try to block this, covering scope and relevance. That's the foundation of what their claim is in Michigan for reconsideration. The error brought upon this court is that Bottomley, Ms. Bottomley in the state of California, filed a complaint with the EEOC. Actually, let's go back a step. She filed a complaint with the state of California version of the EEOC, which is the Department of Housing and something. I can't remember the exact title for it. And 3ABN quickly alleged that they had no jurisdiction. Counsel for the state of California said, gee, I think you're right. This is a religious issue. It's outside of the purview of our mandate. And therefore, if you have a complaint, you have to go to the federal EEOC. And that's exactly what happened, Your Honor. And there's an ongoing investigation of the federal EEOC relating to this very issue because a complaint was filed. Now, that issue, as far as I know, the EEOC and the federal level has never issued a letter to sue. They are still, as far as I know, ongoing in that field investigation relative to the complaints. And I'm sure counsel knows this. How could they not be aware of what's going on such a critical issue? But it really characterizes an example of the fraudulent misrepresentations of counsel in this case. Now, with reference to the subpoena to Pastor Glenn Dryden, Your Honor, some of the allegations relating to the conduct of Mr. Tommy Ray Sheldon, okay, actually occurred on the premises of Three Angels Broadcasting Network. Some of those parties have told us that they went to the president of Three Angels Broadcasting Network, and they made very specific allegations and made it clear to the president that they were not interested in continuing their employment unless this issue was dealt with. These were males who had been approached by a superior member of the staff, and they gave us this very specific information. Now, it is true that there were other allegations outside of Three Needles Broadcasting Network dealing with underage students that were in a school that he managed. And those issues, well, there's a whole story there, and I won't bore the court with that whole story. But the fact is, we know that Three Needles Broadcasting Network, and specifically Danny Lee Shelton, and specifically the chairman of the board of the Three Needles Broadcast Network, Dr. Thompson, I believe, were absolutely aware of these issues, and Dr. Thompson was relegated the responsibility of, quote, investigating them. And now they claim they did a thorough investigation, and yet we have statements from Dr. Thompson which clearly show that he did not do a thorough investigation. That obviously goes to board oversight, Your Honor. Clearly relevant, clearly addressed in the complaint, and clearly an issue. In matter of fact, Your Honor, I'd point out that when we initially started the website, the very first issue that we addressed was the allegations relating specifically to Tommy Ray Shelton. And in fact, if we said we're going to cut this case off as of January 2007, we did a look back and said, what's that going to include? Okay? And ironically, it virtually cuts off everything from Tommy Ray Shelton forward. Most of the website was constructed after January of 2007. And yet they've sought an injunction against that website and the information that's on that website. They've sought that in their complaint. Now, they make another fraudulent statement. They claim plaintiffs have not made claims to ongoing defamation. Your Honor, in the court downstairs in this very building, in the bankruptcy court, motion for relief in the automatic stay, November 13, 2007, it addresses his ongoing continuing conduct, referring to me, and goes on to say his ongoing defamatory conduct towards 3ABN and Shelton, quote, okay, motion for expedited determination, motion for relief in the automatic stay. Okay. In addition to that, Ms. Hayes, when she was managing the case, which is part of the problem here, Ms. Hayes, in fact, went about seeking also third-party subpoenas. And, for example, she sought third-party subpoenas, which went to places like Bluehost, which happens to be the website, and they asked for information on completely irrelevant third-party identifications of people who did use. Now, in all of the postings that I have ever done on the Internet, I have never used anything other than the surname that I was given at birth. And the same for Mr. Pipple, as far as I know. All right? They know that. We've made that very clear. And bottom line is, they went around looking for identifications for people like Sister, and there's a whole litany of people that they were looking for. Clearly beyond the scope and relevance of this case. What does Black SDA and people posting on the Internet, on AdventTalk, or on, what's the other one? I can't remember what it is. It's on the West Coast. How is that relevant to this case? But yet they sought the information. And furthermore, they used that identifying information once they had it. They set up their own site and turned these people's pseudonyms. I'd say that's far more outrageous conduct than anything we have ever done. We have ever done. In summary, Your Honor, we believe that we covered the relevance and the scope in nearly 6 hours of conversation in January of 2008. We absolutely covered to a T every single item, every single request to produce with Ms. Hayes. We talked about the relevance. We talked about the scope. We talked about everything you could possibly think of, including the issues of confidentiality. Those were all discussed. There's no question, we couldn't agree on much, all right? In their opinion, everything was irrelevant, everything was confidential, and obviously everything was beyond the scope of the present case, despite the wrong allegations. And they finally came across with production on 14 of these requests to produce. They couldn't figure out for the life of them, over the course of 6 months, they could not figure out for the life of them, despite correspondence, communications, and on, what it is we were looking for that was specific to this case in the other requests to produce. A virtual ludicrous and a fraud upon this court, to say the least. I believe that we clearly established the relevance of each request in that conversation, and we clearly established both relevance and scope, and explained it through the obviously the complaints of defamation per se, and the other specific allegations made in the underlying claim. We also have allegations regarding government's oversight, which again, that goes over the entire lifespan of Three Angels Broadcasting Network. The financial allegations, for some reason or other, they claim it includes the board. Now, there are three members of the board who are also employed, well, there were four members of the board who are members of the, are also employees of 3ABN. If they refer to those, that's fine. I don't recall us making allegations beyond Mr. Shelton. And, of course, just general board oversight. But they claim we have. But that would clearly cover the entire 25 years, again, from inception to the current period. The relevance of the third party is that these parties clearly had documents.
I'm going to give you just a minute to wrap up.
Okay. They had documents that 3ABN clearly did not have. Obviously, the documents that the accountant, the auditor, has would be documents that they would not have in their possession. The information that Mr. Dryden had in the Brave State of Virginia is information that 3ABN would not have had. The information from the Bottomlands is information they wouldn't have had. The information from, or at least they'd only have part of the information. The information from, obviously, regarding the accounts, we're told very specifically that all records prior to 2000 were destroyed by the plaintiffs who had given that information a year ago. The bottom line is we know that only part of that is there. But regardless, the point is they question relevance and scope. And the fact is that we have a situation where our experts tell us that they need the obviously the checking account information. They need the information found in the auditor's statement. And they clearly need the information from Remnant Publication in order to make a clear, decisive opinion regarding defamation per se, and some of the other allegations in the complaint.
Thank you. Mr. Joel? I'm sorry, Mr. Pickle, how about you? What do you want to add?
Yes, Your Honor. This relates to this motion. In the plaintiff's opposition to my motion to compel on page 11 at the very bottom, says the single defamatory statement remotely related to Danny Shelton's personal finances would make relevant only the title, purchase documents, and payment history for a Toyota Sequoia automobile. And I just think that when we're talking about private enormous, that is just a ludicrous statement, because nothing having to do with that Toyota Sequoia has to do with private enormous. But more importantly, I want to point out that they specified payment information for the Toyota Sequoia automobile. See, the complaint says inter alia, and then it lists a bunch of example statements, but it says inter alia, so it could include other statements. Well, there's nothing in the complaint that specifically talks about the payment information for that Toyota Sequoia, but it is an allegation that the defendants have made based on the payment history of that vehicle and statements by Walt Thompson, and that information, that our allegations, our investigative report about that, was included in the plaintiff's Rule 26A1 material. So this does demonstrate that the plaintiffs do not mind going beyond the allegations that are explicitly stated in their complaint. They will go beyond that when it suits their purpose. I also want to point out that this addresses the question of limiting the scope to a particular time period, the problems that this can result in. In my request to produce in Definition 16G, one of the plaintiff-related issues is allegations of embezzlement regarding, any employees, officers, directors of 3ABN. And I got nothing in regard to that. other than there was a brief blurb in a January 2001 board minute which referred to Alan Lovejoy, the 3ABN auditor, giving a report, an update on Pete Crosser. Now, what we had been told was that Pete Crosser had been associated with the 3ABN auditor, with the auditing firm, and that he had been the CFO of 3ABN. And in the plaintiff's Rule 26A1 material, there is some material written by Sister, a former employee of 3ABN, referring to Pete Crosser. How, as CFO, he was running his personal expenses through 3ABN, paying for his house with 3ABN funds. He was given a van, as like a hush payment, because, you know, what Sister is suggesting or indicating is that he was helping Danny Shelton embezzle funds or inappropriately direct funds. But, and he was given this van. Now, one of the documents we did receive did reference a van that was sold to Pete Crosser, or given to Pete Crosser, in December of 99. And through the documents filed with the state of Illinois for the 2000 tax year, mentioned that their CFO was fired in December of 2000. So, you see, if we limit the scope of discovery just to events occurring from January 2001 onward, then we totally missed the embezzlement, alleged embezzlement that took place under CFO Pete Crosser and all the issues, intertwining issues with that. Now, one thing that Sister did say regarding why there was never any prosecution of Pete Crosser by 3ABN or the plaintiff, because Danny Shelton, in running his operation there, wants to avoid at all costs the transparency that a court case would result in over the finances of 3ABN. And I think we see that, an example of that kind of thing, in this current litigation. They want to avoid financial transparency. And this issue with Pete Crosser isn't the only example of somebody that has embezzled funds or stolen funds that were to go to 3ABN and that it did result in prosecution, allegedly, in order to avoid the kind of investigation that litigation would result in. And what Mr. Stinson said about how 3ABN didn't fire Tommy soon enough, that's just ludicrous. Our understanding is that the board did say that Tommy needed to go around 1991 had propositioned or gone after, this one employee. He went after him, and the guy had to flee his car. Flee the car that he was riding in with Tommy. And after that incident, our understanding is that the board did say Tommy had to go. Well, then he shows back up in 2001, and when these allegations resurfaced in 2003, nothing was done. And when they surfaced again in 2006, nothing was done. We have no indication that Tommy was terminated over these allegations. And in 2006, what was officially reported publicly is that he was retiring early because of alleged health problems. So this idea that 3ABN didn't fire Tommy soon enough is just ludicrous.
All right, thank you.
And I guess. The book royalties, on page 11, I'll mention just a couple other things. On the top of page 11 of the plaintiff's opposition to my motion to compel, it mentions book royalties earned by and paid to 3ABN. And that just garbles the issue, because I don't know that either. I know I have never accused 3ABN as opposed to having royalties paid to them that then were inappropriately paid to Danny Shelton. The issue is that Danny Shelton did not properly disclose his royalties on his financial affidavit or to his board, royalties that he was earning from his book deals with Remnant. That was the issue. On the bottom of page 10 of their opposition, which is document 67, It says 3ABN donations to Shreve Peters' ministry and records of any orders issued by 3ABN's board. For Ebony says donations. That's totally garbage issue. That's not the issue. The allegation that we received from a high-level 3ABN individual was that the board had said that Brandy Elswick Murray, who became Brandy Shelton, Danny's wife, the board did not want her to be paid. And that then Danny arranged for money to be paid through a third-party nonprofit. Whether that third-party nonprofit was Shreve Peters' ministry or not, don't know. But I don't know of any allegation that the 3ABN board ever prohibited donations to Shreve Peters' ministry. So that this, the plaintiffs are gargling the issues that, of this controversy. And just one other thing, which is a key point. We're approaching, I guess we're about a year now after the beginning of discovery, and I still do not have documents that that we can use to verify that former donors stopped giving to 3ABN because of alleged lies that we were telling. And the plaintiffs want to prevent us from being able to verify those kind of things, verify the truth or falsity of that claim, that we have lied, that we've made statements that are definitely false, and that our activity, rather than other people's activity, has caused a decline in donations. The plaintiffs, by trying to restrict the scope of discovery, are trying to prevent us from finding, discovering documents that directly pertain to those questions. And I think that's it, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, everybody. Under advisement.